Well, I expected you all to be practically blown away today here after your CCH2. I understand you found some walls. Today I'm going to talk to you about universes, a very important thing. You'll find most of these lectures are concerned with fundamentals, but they're fundamentals about fundamentals probably about which you've never heard. The whole of the subject of Scientology has to do with knowingness. Hence, its very definite definition of the science of knowing how to know. Knowingness is above all other things. Every now and then, you're going to get somebody coming along telling you that thinkingness is knowingness. It's not. There's a nodal mystery scale. A person does not think about what he knows. He knows what he knows. And sometimes you're studying something and studying it and studying it and studying it, and you're thinking about it and thinking about it and trying to figure it out and so forth. And then one day, all of a sudden, you know it. And you've just done a terrific jump on a scale known as the nodal mystery scale. Because thinkingness, worryingness, puzzlingness are way down low on that scale, and knowingness is clear on up to the top of it. Now, an individual who knows just knows. That's a fundamental that is too fundamental for anybody to grasp. That is too fundamental. Now, an individual who knows some symbols is, again, way down below on the scale. He just knows some symbols. He doesn't know these things. Now, knowing by symbols, to a large degree, is knowing on a via. But when a person is doing a totality of symbols, or a totality of figure-figure, or a totality of mystery or confusion, symbols can be used to put him on a road to knowingness. It is possible for this to happen. And that's what we are doing here, essentially. We're not trying to give you a great many symbols. We're not the medical profession, after all. We're not trying to give you a great number of things to memorize. We're trying to lead you to know something. And when you know it, it won't be because I told you to know it. It will be because you yourself have observed it and now know it. And the only thing I can do for you is to tell you to look in a certain direction. And when you've looked in that direction, if you saw anything that was totally because you saw it. Do you understand? So all I can do is show you that there is a trail, there is a pattern, and there are certain things, more important than other things, at which you can look, and that there are certain stable items, there are certain definite things or knowingnesses which are quite senior, quite superior to other knowingnesses. Now, when we go into any flight of this character, we bypass practically every subject or science or academic study there is. Scientology will never be an academic study. It is directionalizing someone's observation to get them to observe and, if possible, then know. But people in observing can still flinch. And they can still go chasing off down some side road. And you show them a black panther, and you say, that's a black panther. Now, if you look over in the corner, you see a black panther. There's a black panther there. Everybody agrees there's a black panther there. You expect this person will now look over the black corner, in the corner, and notice this black panther sitting there. And do you know something? A great many people will not look at the corner. A great many more will not even stay in the room. And the largest percentage of them will unfortunately find something entirely different in the corner. They'll find a pantherous negress, male, certain age, certain type, from a certain place, but they won't find a black panther. Get the idea? They'll find a bunch of fias. Every once in a while, you point somebody's attention in some particular direction, and you say, look over there. And you run into a factor that you'll be having a lot to do with, known as confrontingness. And instead of confronting the reality of that thing, they tumble right on downscale and confront some lower part of the reality scale. They confront something else. There are many people who have started into a study of Scientology and have wound up sitting on a mountaintop meditating. All the things they were shown, they couldn't look at. So they decided to kind of introvert and let the rest of the world go by. You get the idea? Now, it takes a little bit of nerve sometimes to confront the world about us and to confront the various universes there are. In fact, it takes so much nerve that every human being there is at this time is failing totally to confront the second universe about which I'm talking, the universe of the mind. The whole of the professions of the mind up to the advent of Dianetics and Scientology would not confront the mind. This is one of the most interesting, unbelievable things there is about this subject. Because it was there to see. But you'll find all sorts of interesting things about this second universe, such as, well, it's imaginary. That settles the whole thing, you see. Oh, yes, it gives people sciatica and arthritis and lumbosis, and it ruins their lives and starts wars and so forth, but it's all imaginary. There's nothing real about the mind. It's all imaginary. That's one of the first things that you hear from 19th century subjects, that a mental image picture is imaginary. It's not even a statement, you see. It's not imaginary or anything else. It simply is. Now, it has many other characteristics. It has many characteristics that you could then describe, but only on looking at it. You can't discard the whole thing by saying it's imaginary, because in doing that, then you discard the whole rationale of psychosomatic illness, of aberration, insanity. All of these things you just throw overboard. And say, well, we go study druids and trees. Now, that's an interesting subject. We can confront that. But the people actually can't confront the mind. Now, there are four universes in essence, and people are trying very hard right now to confront the fourth and the third. But the world outside Scientology, which is one of the things that will provoke you as a Scientologist, are not at all confronting the second or the first. Now, what are these universes? You should know them rather well, since they are quite different universes. And they are highly specialized, each one. And yet, they all stem from the first. Now, the first universe is the universe of the spirit. We call this a Greek letter, which was the letter the Greek used to represent thought. And that is what Thetan means. Thetan isn't any odd word. It's theta. Now, you'll occasionally hear it pronounced theta, and so on. Well, this would merely be an argument amongst the Greeks. Now, theta is a symbol in Greek to represent thought, but to us, is used to represent the beingness, the person, the individual, I. Now, you'll find some counterpart of this in other studies, but none of them compare to it, so don't fall into a trap. Because these other studies haven't understood this thing, their definitions for it are then not adequate, don't you see? It has to be specially defined in order to understand what we mean by it. Religion was the only area where this first universe had any credence. And religion of later years, not condemning it at all, but just commenting on it, was talking about you must save your soul. That's pretty good. If you ever want to get a good laugh out of a bunch of auditors, say, well, one of these days, I'm getting so disgusted that one of these days I'm going to turn in my Thetan. You see, saving your soul leaves us in this horrible conundrum. Who's you? Who are you, and what's this thing you've got in your hip pocket called a soul? I don't know. Religion, ghost stories, these things took up this thing called the spirit. But they meant so many different things by it, just as your spiritualist also has an astral body. And when you exteriorize somebody, this is a known operation to a spiritualist, and he says at once, oh, you mean you made the person step out of his corporeal body in his astral body? He's saying, no, come on, no. How did we get that we're in this mess? No, what we did essentially is I asked him to exteriorize, and he, a Thetan, stepped out of his head. Oh, he said, that's right, the astral body walking. We know all about that. Well, we go further than that. We even know what an astral body is. An astral body is simply accumulation of rather solidified facsimiles of somebody who was so dumb that he got into a FAC-1 machine. He got implanted, in other words. And he believes and has an energy accumulation that he calls a body. But that isn't a Thetan. No. A Thetan is defined very thoroughly in the first axioms of the axioms of Scientology. There's actually no further description than that. There's a description of his capabilities. You could go further about what he can do. But about a Thetan, it actually is something that has no mass, no wavelength, actually no position, unless he so declares it. And is that thing from which you get matter, energy, space, and time. Now, we're talking about beingness. Until you realize, well, when you get to be an operating Thetan, you realize you authored all this. And if you go totally crazy, why, you will know you did. The man who gets into a God valence is just going on the mockery inversion, you see, of an actuality. And the individual, Thetan, creates many things, knowingly or unknowingly. And the remaining universes actually stem out from this first universe. But because other universes stem from this first universe, let's not neglect the existence of this first universe. Well, let's recognize with considerable clarity that an individual is, and that he has capabilities, and that he is not a mass. He's really not a location. Unfortunately, when you have no mass, no location, no space, of course, you have at the same time no reality, as ARC is defined, because it doesn't advertise until it advertises, and so it isn't. But that's no reason why it isn't aware. You see, awareness is not actually a total thing. Just as I said, knowingness is way up top scale. So awareness is right along with knowingness. There has to be something to know before you can know a thing, but there has to be something doing the knowingness. Now, let's not omit the something that does the knowingness, something that does the creatingness, and so on. Let's start in where we should start, which is a thetan. Anything that is alive either has or shares a thetan. When I say shares, I'm thinking of these vast ant armies and things like that. And every once in a while you look into this, you will puzzle over this one too. Is this vast bunch of ants being run by one thetan, or does each ant have a thetan, or what's this all about? And there are a series of experiments that you can actually conduct that lead you in the direction of making up your own mind concerning it. One of them is take an ant as he scurries along and make him turn around by putting a match or something in front of him. And you keep turning him around, annoying him, annoying him. After a while, you become aware that something someplace is getting angry. It's quite odd. Now, to decide, does each blade of grass and each cell have a thetan? Or is it a thetan? You'd have to also have a total awareness of how capable something might be in creating. Now, can you create something that is apparently alive? Well, I'm afraid you can. So we can't make a definite statement and say that everything that is alive is inhabited by a thetan. So we can't say that. Well, we can say with great definiteness that every human being you run into is a thetan plus an identity plus a number of combinations, automatic responses, plus a body in a physical universe. We can say that. We know that positively. Now, whether every cell there is a thetan, whether every ant there is a thetan, that's something, well, in the first place, we don't have to know it. In the second place, you yourself poking around and get into your own trouble solving this one, okay? Now, that first universe has as its most intimate next universe, the mind. Now, the mind is in itself a total universe. It's a true universe in that it has space, it has mass, it has energy, and it has its own independent time. And that is the mind. Now, the number of things which can be in a mind are about the number of things which a thetan can dream up or postulate. And that is pretty close to infinite. There's all sorts of things, items, spaces, conditions that can exist with regard to a mind. Now, fortunately for us, any thetan in this universe is doing or creating or composing these things in the mind according to a certain pattern. There are certain basic laws he follows in order to have all of these combinations stay that way in a mind. You'll find in the axioms a list of these postulates that more or less have to be made in order to keep a mind that way. And the axioms are simply the rules of a universe of the mind that makes it a mind. Unfortunately, we know those things. Otherwise, we would go totally adrift. We'd never be able to take anybody's mind apart or process anybody or do anything with anybody. It would be all impossible. Because the number of things that can be in a mind, the number of conditions that can be in a mind, are as many things as a thetan could dream up. And that's the thing he does best, dream things up. They're just an infinite number. But they are all dreamed up according to certain definite patterns. And if a person is here in this universe to be processed by you, he dreamed them up according to the axioms. You understand? So that gives us at once a little more than 50 stable data that you have to know pretty well about how the mind is and how it got that way. In spite of the fact that there's an infinite variety of things that could appear to be different. So at once, let us isolate the known from the possible or the unknown. The known are the axioms. And the possibles, it doesn't mean that the fellow got here or dreamed these things up in some different way. He dreamed them up all according to the rules, but there's an infinite number of things he could have dreamed up, you see? Infinite number of postulates. You start getting into the number of postulates and the types of postulates and the types of ideas and the conflicts amongst them, which a person runs into as he goes through an engram, let us say, and you'll say, oh, wow, how can anybody be mixed up? He can cause himself tremendous trouble with these things. For instance, I'll give you an example of a random postulate. A problem is something that cannot be solved. Here, think that over for a minute. A problem is something that cannot be solved. Now, this individual decided this. So that somebody tells him he has a problem making his bus every evening. Obviously, to this person, the bus can never be made. He never can get on the bus. Don't you see? The person has a problem with his family. Well, obviously, there's nothing you could do about it of any kind whatsoever, because by definition, it's something that couldn't be solved. And you follow this down, reductio ad absurdum, and you say then the problem, 2 plus 2 equals 4, is not susceptible to solution. Is that correct? And this person will tell you, that's correct. Oh, but wait a minute, you say the solution of the problem is 4. They say, well, then it's not a problem. And you'll say, can this individual be thinking at all? Is he capable of analytical awareness at all? Oh, yes, he is. But he's walking through life across a number of road blocks of some magnitude. He's made up a whole bunch of obstacles. And although they're all made up according to the axioms, the rules of their makeup was according to the axioms, they have specialized characteristics. Now that's the variety you run into. And don't you ever make the mistake, please, of saying just because somebody can make up his mind to an infinite number of things, that there are then no rules by which he does it. Because you yourself at that moment are asking to get lost and to be standing in the middle of a vast forest of trees, not knowing which way to go or what to do. You just remember that if he made the postulate, he made it according to certain rules, and it comes apart according to certain rules, and those rules are found in the axioms. That's heartening to know. That's what makes Scientology a subject. Scientology, at this instant, is actually a world monopoly on the field of human thought and reason, also on religion. That's a mouthful, but it's true. It's a world monopoly. Use the monopoly as in, doesn't mean that it's held down, nailed down, nobody can have it. But it does mean that you won't find this information anyplace else. Now, what's the third universe? The second universe is the mind. What's this third universe? Well, it's actually really a sort of a subdivision, a sort of a Q&A rather than a real universe. I mean, you could argue about this. But to most people, it is a universe, so we include it in it. And we include a body. A body is apparently a universe. Actually, they've made a whole science out of it, haven't they? And a body plus its immediate possessions is just about as much universe as lots of people have. They've completely lost the second universe. They have no awareness at all of the first universe, and this leaves them with a body. And whether that body is warm or cold, or whether or not it is sitting in a certain room, is their greatest and practically only concern. So it must be a kind of a universe. Now, the whole of medical science is composed around this thing called a body, so there must be a lot to know about a body. Well, the one thing they never cover directly in medical science is where did it come from and how did it get that way? They start telling you all sorts of things about birth. I don't know what this has got to do with the creation of a body. You can take somebody and make him go through all of the agonies and somatics of birth without having a baby appear. A birth is not the source of a body, nor is sex the source of a body. It's merely the mechanics by which a body arrives. And I don't know that one can't just appear, unless somebody's made up a whole set of rules by which it must appear. Well, the rules by which it must appear are more or less the rules by which this universe lives. The rules by which a body must appear, and the rules by which it must continue, and the rules by which it must die, are all a special set of rules. Very, very remarkable rules, too. Now, the mind tremendously influences the body. Tremendously. Because the mind is a created thing, the body is a created thing. But the body is a sort of a calling card. The mind does not give you at once the individual's identity, but the body does. Somebody comes along and presents you with a body. That's his calling card. That's his identity. And that's about what a body is. A body is something that makes people aware of a thing. And that's the way it's done. You know, do it some other way is not cricket. I remember distinctly one fellow who was terribly upset. He was consistently and continually upset because nobody upset would accept the clanking of chains as a good, valid announcement of his presence. People would all run away every time he made the sound of clanking chains. And after a while, he got totally discouraged and stopped being a ghost. And this has happened to so many people that there's hardly a castle now in the whole of Europe that has a good, honest, hard-working, self-respecting ghost in it. Now, the fourth universe is the obvious one. That is the universe of matter, energy, space, and time, common to each and every one of the Thetans in that universe. Now, because there is a physical universe, does not mean there are no other physical universes. Because another crew of Thetans, agreeing on another time track, could have a universe just behind this one and just ahead of it, don't you see? This is something that you also can go, wow, wow, trying to figure out. But this universe is so precisely on a time track, and everyone accepts so precisely its time track, that it's a universe in common to a great many Thetans. But just as the early explorers, not the learned ones, but the people who were financing them and so forth, the early people interested in exploration, tended to scoff a little bit at there being anything beyond Italy or Portugal, Spain, France. Obviously, that was the center of the world, and obviously, there wasn't any more world. And, of course, if you sailed out in some direction or another, you'd drown, or a wild beast would get you, or things ended, or they didn't know what was over there. But the only thing that was real to them was the immediate town and maybe the countryside, and then by hearsay, the rest in which they resided, and by hearsay, the rest of Europe. This is pretty odd. They just knew this much, And even though there was that much, they didn't pay any attention to the that much. They just looked at this much down here. And they said, this is it. This is it. There's nothing else. Now, I can go back and dig up textbooks printed not more than 10 or 15 years ago, which advise you that Earth is the only inhabited planet. Well, how did they get such an idea as Earth is the only inhabited planet? It's come up as a brand new scientific idea in just the last couple of decades, not amongst science fictioners, but it's come up as a new scientific idea amongst physicists and so forth, that other planets might be inhabited. Well, I think this is absolutely fantastic. Look out there and look at all these suns, and they have some kind of an idea of the way planets are formed, and even Charles A. Lindbergh, flying through the superstratosphere, found Earth was shedding spores, and you might say seeds, one kind or another, all through space, just raking nets through the upper stratosphere. And so what found out that very, very light, tiny seeds and so forth were passing right straight on out of Earth. Well, here's Earth strewing a whole track. You mean this stuff in the past billions of years has never at any time ever lighted any place else? Just saying that Earth is the source of all this, which it isn't. But we're into an imponderable. How could anybody imagine that this was the only inhabited planet in this whole, well, galaxy, much less universe? That takes a wild piece of imagination from the way I look at it. How egocentric can people get? What conceit? They say, oh, this is one planet that's inhabited. Silly. All right, now I give you that. Let's look at the idea that there's only one physical universe. This takes some egocentricity itself to suppose that this universe, because it's so solid to us, is the only universe there is. All you'd have to do is shift the time factor by about 15 or 20 seconds, and you'd have a whole different universe. All you'd have to do is skid on the time track just 15 or 20 seconds, and you're liable to wind up someplace else. I don't know how anybody stays in this universe. Gosh, you wake up every morning and say, did I make it? What alertness. Well, we could say, although we can't pound it down with a hammer and say that this universe is here and visible to us because it is made by us. But I think you would come very, very close to the truth. I'm unwilling to settle that thud across the boards as I am several other problems, because as individuals go upscale, they like to discover them themselves. And there's no danger of upsetting anybody to having missing this piece of information. One, are you one person or are you part of a big Satan? The idea of everybody is kind of mishmashed into one person and so forth is a very favorite idea in some countries. Most revolutions get started on the basis of we're all one. They say it in different ways, but they have a revolutionary religious basis. They say, well, we're all one, and so on. That's the overt act motivator sequence at work, the truth of the matter, which I'm not going to thrust down your throat, is apparently that you are you. And I won't say that's all you are, but that is definitely indicated by all the facts. But you find a lot of people around that say you are somebody else. And you'll find a lot of skitzes in sanitariums that are being different people at different times all in the same day, you see. So much so that they therefore must be different people anyhow, and then for all people must be the same. If you're good and crazy, you can believe this, that all people are one. This doesn't mean that you can't communicate across to other people without going through mess, though, you know. It doesn't mean a lot of things, but you are definitely you. But this physical universe is definitely this physical universe, and it probably is here with us, and we don't lose it all the time because we keep on mocking it up. Now, those are the four universes we are most intimately interested in. We're only interested in the body because it's a sort of a fad at this time. People have bodies. Other times they have robots. Other times they have dolls. Other times they have sets of chains. They're known by the tin cans they rattle or something of this sort. There are different fads at different times along the track. So you'd say the body universe would be the calling card or being this universe. One of the reasons Scientology is important at this time, looking again at this body universe, is because nobody issued you a book of operating instructions. Now, you can look around in a body when you get it, and you won't find any book of operating instructions in its pocket. Another thing is, when you made up your own mind, looking at the second universe, when you made up your mind, you very seldom issued yourself a book of operating instructions concerning how you made it up. So you had to be found out. Because you'd forgotten. And so had everybody else. How do you make up one of these silly things called a mind? It's got machines and things and stuff and pictures and spaces and all sorts of things in it. How do you make one up? Well, you'd have to know how to make one up in order to take one apart. Not necessarily. You could blow one apart. Several therapists have tried this in the past. There was some cult, I think it was called, just a minute, I'll get it. It's a cult of psychiatry, 19th century, mid-19th century psychiatry. Originated in Russia. And this cult actually believed that the way you solve somebody's mind was to electrocute them. See, if his thinkingness wasn't all right, why, then you electrocuted them and you had it made, you see. And sometimes there was another one called the psychologist back about the same period, and they believed if you bored holes in a brain, that evil would leak out. I think I may have my data wrong because I haven't had money enough lately to send out an archaeological expedition to find out what happened to these people. But the truth of the matter is they had some very peculiar ideas. The longer you're in Scientology, the more peculiar these ideas will look to you. The only trouble of it is sometimes you're quite horrified by what they do and what they used to do, the witch doctor sort of thing with the gourd rattle or the auger or the shock machine or some such thing. And you don't confront it as something funny. I'm not going to tell you will someday confront this as funny because it's really not very funny. A funeral is funny. I remember when I first started to laugh at funerals. It was very funny. I mean, it was back about 1952. I was waiting on a side road, and here was this great big hearse came by, you know, and it was just heaped with flowers, you know, and people came along back of it in great big limousines, you know, and they were all wearing black crepe, and everybody was sobbing, and back of that were more limousines and more people, and there were more limousines and more people, and I watched this thing go by and realized that they were going to put something in a hole in the ground. And I had just completed a series of studies on the subject of exteriorization, and I had tabulated exactly what a person does with regard to death, you see? And it looked very funny to me. I could see the Thetan, you know, following along the funeral train up above you. Are they doing it all right? Are they being respectful enough? Yes. As we look over, the earlier studies of these four universes, we find a great many clumsy assumptions and a great many heroic remedies. Nuclear physics is the final remedy of physics. They're trying to cure the whole subject, I suppose. It's very, very wonderful to look at the amount of work and endeavor being put in to destroying this many mock-ups this fast, you see. Wholly pointless, but individuals are doing it, and they are engaged on it, and nations are spending a great deal of money in order to do this. But the only thing they ever do is bring about a further confusion. Unless you unmock a mock-up or hit it at source or take it apart by looking at it as ising it, we say, unless we do it that way, we're just going to get more mishmash. It's just going to be a big mess. And the more times we blow something up, like a mind or a body, the more times we blow something up, the more times we destroy it by mauling it around, the harder it is to look at what was wrong in the first place, because it's just being stirred up and mixed up, don't you see? So most remedies in these four universes have been based on destruction. We were going to remedy everything by destroying it. The mind, they were going to destroy the mind by boring holes in the brain or by electrocuting somebody or doing something like that. That's the way they were going to remedy the mind. All they will ever do is bring about a further confusion in the mind. As far as the body is concerned, they're going to put it under ether and they're going to operate on it and they're going to go this way and that way and do this and do that and fill it full of medicine and hang it up by its heels and let the medicine run out. Whatever they're going to do with it, you finally wind up, they have a more messed up body than they had previously. Now, it's perfectly all right with me if they set somebody's legs, but look at the orderliness of setting somebody's leg. Look at the disorderliness of cutting out somebody's gallbladder. If you want to patch up plumbing, all right, call it patching up plumbing. If you want to do carpentry or welding work on the body, why, all right, it's perfectly okay. But the funny part of it is, even that leaves its own trauma, because the destruction and the basic difficulty was not gotten rid of. All they did was patch up something after the fact. And the physical universe, nobody's ever going to do anything about this physical universe until they look at where it comes from. And if the nuclear physicist is trying to get rid of people, if that's his goal, why, okay, he could get rid of them much better other ways. Birth control, things like that, if he really has to get rid of all the people on Earth, or if he's trying to just blow the universe out of the firmament, he's not going to get any place doing that. He'd better find out where it came from before he did something about it. I don't even know what he's trying to do with the universe. But you'll find the physical universe is based on certain laws, and these laws are called the laws of physics. You don't have to know anything about the laws of physics if you don't want to. Some people are allergic to these laws, because they've been made to study them too hard. But when an apple falls, it is obeying the law of gravity. There's Boyle's law, and there's the laws of acceleration, and there's laws of expansion of gases, and coefficient of expansion by thermal distortion, all kinds of interesting laws. You can find them all in a basic physics textbook. Not too many of these laws. You find everything in the universe is more or less obeying these laws. Nuclear physicist has found a few laws he doesn't know where to place. And he thinks he's escaped the law of gravity and a few other things. And nothing is funnier than to see some nuclear physicist step off of a ladder and hit the ground, because he hasn't gotten rid of any of the laws that apply to him. He's still obeying the law of gravity, even though he thinks there are holes in space and that he is destroying energy by blowing up atom bombs and so forth. It's not true that he is disobeying any of the laws. And when he looks a little distance, he'll find he's still within the basic laws of the universe.
I don't particularly rag nuclear physicists anymore. There are a great many nuclear physicists who are Scientologists. And if they weren't held captive by governments and things like that, why, they would undoubtedly long since of their own accord have done something about an atom bomb. But the atom bomb has now become the property of a general. And various generals own these atom bombs, and they're not interested in the scientific import. They're merely interested in the military objective. That nobody has defined the military objective to them is beside the point. They're still interested in the military objective of these bombs. The end product of war and government is apparently denuding Earth of business and people. That's apparently its end product. But regardless of what its end product is, the atom bomb follows certain laws. The body follows certain laws. The mind follows certain laws. And Satan, as hard as he tries to make a postulate that makes him follow different laws, still follows laws directly related to a thing. Now, we are rich at this time in that we know these laws. You know, we didn't dream up the laws of the physical universe. In Scientology, we found a few of them they didn't know existed. But this is not any vast part of our sphere. Almost any physicist is better off for knowing Scientology, as many of them will tell you. But we're not too interested in that. We're above the point of the creation of the universe when we're in Scientology. Therefore, the laws of creation of the universe are just another set of laws to us. Those laws are basically postulates. Now, a body obeys a certain series of laws, and a person inhabiting it abides by certain things, and he does certain things. He Q's and A's with the demands of this body and how it's constructed and how he makes other bodies and so forth. In other words, it goes by certain laws, and all of these laws are basically postulates. And we come back to the mind, and we find out minds are very different in content and behavior, but they obey certain laws, and all of these laws are postulates. And we come back and we look at the first universe, and we find that we have a Satan, and there's something he can't do a single thing about. He's a Satan. And below that, he has made up a series of laws which gives him the other universes. The fact of being a Satan is not something anybody dreamed up. It is. But when a bunch of Satans get together and agree with great duress on a number of postulates, and they say, this is it, and this is the way it works, and by natural selection sort of get the ones that people don't agree with so well out of the road, they get a working structure which you then call a universe. There's only one universe along the line which you can't do anything about. You can change all these other universes, change any universe or set universes back together again, because they're just laws, and all of those laws are simply agreed upon postulates. They're considerations. Some fine day you'll be getting processed and you'll all of a sudden hit one of these considerations that you've contributed to one way or the other, and you'll see the corners of the room starting going creak, 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 and you'll say, ah, 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 ah. I shouldn't have touched that one. And it's with great relief that you can go ahead and touch it again and then find out that you can consciously put the center of the room or the corners of the room back where they should have belonged in the first place and still go on living in the room without burying the law out of sight the way you thought you had to. Nevertheless, a Satan, first and foremost, a being called you, can be modified by other opinions, conditions, surroundings, environments, can be modified by postulates, by universes, and so forth, but only in its own belief. Only beliefs can be modified, and these beliefs lead to such things as beingnesses and capabilities and incapabilities and all sorts of expressions of personality and individualities. But a Satan is, and he has certain characteristics which are apparently unalterable. And these characteristics are practically totally summed up. Certainly all of them are summed up in the first 10 axioms of Scientology. These are native characteristics, you might say. We are a being, and we are studying a being that is. All other things are mutable, changeable, susceptible to alteration. The whole of the mind can be altered. All of its laws can be knocked out, other laws put back in. The whole of the body can be changed, shifted, altered when you get up high enough. And when you're way, way, way up high, you can even do something about the physical universe in changing it around. And once in a while, you find somebody who's gotten up to a state of clear, and you tell him to... Now, just look at that little set of atoms over there and get the idea that you know exactly where they came from. And of course, they disappear, and that's it. And he said, I shouldn't have done that. You say, well, go ahead and put them back. Well, I can't do that. Now, you say, now, look, you got rid of them, you can put them back. All right, if you say so. So he gets the idea of them having been created a long time ago, and that he's now forgotten when they were created, and they're back. He finds out how he does this, you see. There's just little tricks by which he buries things out of sight and creates something and then says he didn't and makes up something that he's totally responsible for. Say, I have no responsibility for it whatsoever. I don't know where it came from. And by this process, he gradually gets the permanence that you observe, or the setness, or the tremendous unchangeability of these additional three universes. The unchangeability of his own mind, the unchangeability of the body, the unchangeability of the physical universe, all of these things come about by these various tricks that he plays on himself. Says, I can't change it, I haven't any responsibility for it, I haven't this, I haven't that, and so forth. Processes aimed directly at the mind upset these basic concepts on his own part and take apart things which he has long ago forgotten how to take apart, and sets things right which he has long ago messed up and wishes he hadn't, and puts things back in order for him, or puts back into his hands the power to put these things back in order. Now, the first impression that you get as you study at HPA-HCA level, the first impression that you get is the only thing that can be changed is the mind. And we're not terribly interested in exceeding that in this particular course. The only thing that can be changed is the mind. Well, the mind can be changed. It is changed because it operates on certain basic laws, but it is more fluid. It is less fixed and it's less set. Dianetics talks about the anatomy of the mind. Scientology knows about four universes. Dianetics is totally dedicated to one universe, which is to say, the universe of the mind. And Dianetics means dianous, through mind. As we look this over, we find out that by knowing the laws of the mind, by knowing how the mind operates, by knowing precisely how it got that way, we, of course, can change it around into some better circumstance and condition. And in view of the fact that minds have been changed around so much, so thoroughly, and so haphazardly in the last Lord knows how many millennia, or millions of years, or trillions, about time somebody went back to basics and put one back together again the way it should go. You'll find out people are happier when this is done. The proof of the pudding is always the eating. Always. The proof of it is that people feel better when their minds get straightened out. Now, I wouldn't say they would feel better if their physical universe got straightened out and they could walk on ceilings. I wouldn't say they would feel better running doll bodies or robot bodies than they are running human bodies. I personally believe they would feel better, but that's a matter of opinion, don't you see? And we come back to the one positive thing that you could address, and that is the capabilities of the individual himself and those things which impinge most closely upon him, which are his ideas, his experiences, the illnesses which he is unwittingly packing around, infecting himself with, the insanities that he held close to his bosom, Lord knows how long ago, you see, but now has no further use for. All of these various things, you will find he is in considerable dissatisfaction with. His condition of body stems from his condition of mind, and his ability to observe the physical universe stems directly from his own concept, the first universe, ability to perceive and create. We're interested, basically, then, in this second universe. We can know this most easily, we can take it apart most readily, and by doing so, we can graduate upstairs to a point of knowingness on the other three universes. So our immediate focus of address is upon this second universe, the universe of the mind. And we'll look that over and see what makes it that way. Thank you. That's a 15-minute break, isn't it? All right. You're going to get a lot of talking at here in this particular unit 3 days a week. I hope some of the information is of use to you. Why don't you take a 15-minute break now, and we'll begin on the second hour.